League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
You can't describe yourself as a podcast about film music without talking to the occasional composer. And we've been joined by a fair few of the best, from Clint Mansell to Justin Hurwitz and Nicholas Britell to Jeff Barrow, Ben Salisbury and Philip Selway. Without exception, each has cast the projects they've been involved with in a new light and given us exclusive insights into the subtleties of their craft. So I'm absolutely delighted to finally bring you Daniel Pemberton in a piece recorded a few months back in his London studio. Daniel is hot property right now, having worked with Ridley Scott, Guy Ritchie, Danny Boyle and Aaron Sorkin. He's now provided the score for Ocean's 8, which is out around the globe already, but in the UK on Monday the 18th of June. We'll hear examples of his compositions for all these world-class directors throughout the conversation, as well as some cracking stories. But we begin with a track called First Excursion from Mike Oldfield's Omadhon, one of the first albums he ever possessed. Daniel, we've finally got there, because we've been communicating via social media for quite a few months now, trying to sort this out, so thank you for having me. This is kind of weird doing an introduction now, because we've just spent the last sort of half hour having a coffee and chatting, and walking from Borough Market to your house stroke studio, which we're now in. This is amazing. It's like a flat out of a film, how I imagine a composer to live and work. I delved into videos of you on YouTube, of kind of you talking about what you do, and I totally geeked out at you geeking out about what you do. And it's really infectious how into your work you are.
Yeah.
That's really evident, really immediately with you. Is the soundtracks and composing what you've always wanted to do? Because it feels like it's kind of, you kind of came out the womb.
I guess so. Like, I kind of really wanted to start making electronic music when I was like a kid.
How old?
I wasn't very interested in music when I was growing up. And then my dad took me to the Planetarium by Madame Tussauds, which doesn't exist anymore because they're idiots. They got like some Marvel superhero video. But anyway, I went there and we watched a laser show, you know, like Here Are the Planets. And hearing this music, I was just like, whoa, what the hell's this? And my brain just kind of, like something flicked a switch. I really, really strongly remember just sitting in the car outside Pet Shop Boys on the radio, left my own devices, and suddenly like this whole world of music had just like opened up. Wow. And my dad went to the library the next day and got me two CDs, which were Jean-Michel Jarre, Rendezvous, and Mike Oldfield, Omadhon, which I copied onto a sort of 90-minute cassette, 45 minutes each side, great length. And I basically played that cassette pretty much non-stop every day for a year, well, probably longer than that.
Thank you.
I just was obsessed suddenly by these kind of worlds of sound and music. Because I wasn't really into pop music. I was really interested in this kind of worlds that kind of music was creating. And then I kind of got really into like that kind of stuff. And then I think it was kind of around sort of early 90s when electronic ambient music was kind of happening. And I really responded to that because, again, it was about creating worlds out of sound. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really about writing songs. And I found it really exciting and liberating and different. And that kind of set me on the path, I guess. So I made a record when I was like 16,
right?
Yeah.
Bedrooms.
Yeah. Bedroom just making weird sounds, and through that I met a director and I started working with him. And then I kind of realized record labels want to do my second album, but I started to see quite quickly in the music industry, I always thought it was this really free place of like just do what you want, but you know, I remember being at a record label and they were talking about the track listing for another artist's album. I was thinking, what, like they don't choose their own order of track listings? And I remember just thinking, doing this TV stuff, I just get to be really free. I get to, like, even though it was at the time it was very much looked down upon as a kind of commercial sellout, for me it just meant I got to try every type of music genre, just play around in them.
Yeah.
And so from like an artistic point of view, it just meant I was constantly creative and I was just constantly creating rather than creating one thing and then selling it for 2 years and then doing it again. So I loved that, and that sort of pushed me on this path towards film, which in essence is kind of the same idea back when I was a kid, is creating these sound worlds. And then the weirdest thing is when I sometimes drive back, I often work at Abbey Road. Well, I get cab back very late at night sometimes. I'm really tired. And the driver will often take this route and he stops. If they take this route past Baker Street, they'll stop just by this point
where
by
the planetarium
is. And if I'm really tired, I got really like emotional sometimes just spotting it and just thinking, how the hell did I go from there as like a sort of 12-year-old kid to now?
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's quite magic.
That's amazing. Did you play lots of instruments when you were a kid then? Or were you?
Not really. I kind of like played the piano a bit.
Because you've just done a live keyboard solo for me.
Yeah, that's not very hard.
Yeah, and there's so many instruments around. Is it that kind of where you kind of, where you're coming up creatively with ideas and you go, oh, I need this instrument. And so if you can't play it, you'll just learn it and teach yourself.
Yeah, slightly. I mean, I kind of say I'm good enough. If you don't know much about the piano, I can convince you I'm really good. If you do know about the piano, you know I'm not. And then guitar, I'm pretty lousy at. But even like being lousy at things, I think I kind of try and work on that being a strength sometimes,
yeah.
Trying to make that weakness an interesting feature of what I do. So I'll write something and might end up being very musically simple because I can't play the guitar maybe that great on that track. But that means I put way more effort into how I play that or think about it in a very different way. So it's got something that's got a hook to it rather than just the notes.
Yeah. One of the reasons it's taken us so long to actually get in a room together to talk is because you have been so busy. I mean, even just in the last couple of months, some of the films that you worked on, All Money in the World, I really enjoyed it. I mean, there's a whole amazing story. I mean, I don't know how they managed to do that with Christopher Plummer. You're trying to find seams. It's amazing how that was able to
I have the Kevin Spacey version here, which technically maybe I shouldn't have. But,
wow.
But, you know.
It's going to fetch you a lot of money in years to come. Molly's Game as well, which Aaron Sorkin's directorial debut, which is kind of bonkers in itself to think that it's taken him this long to direct. But yeah, and you're working on Ocean's 8 at the minute as well. What makes you sign up for a project?
It's kind of like, can I get excited about it? Like, if I can kind of look at something and think, okay, I could do something interesting here. Mm-hmm. That's really it. It's like, can I do something that I feel is going to be different or exciting?
Is that from reading the script or is that from...
It's everything. It's like the directors. It's, you know, it's like if you have a film like Molly's Game, for instance, with Aaron, you don't know what the score is to that. You kind of go, like, what's that going to sound like? And when I go, what's that going to sound like? That's kind of exciting.
Yeah.
Like, when you kind of go, I've got to work this out. I've got to work out a way of telling this story. I love trying to tell each story quite differently.
Mm-hmm.
So that is always the exciting thing for me, is like, how do I tell this story or this film in a different manner? And like, something that feels very unique to that film. I don't know, I get offered stuff. It's really weird. I get offered stuff like every couple of days at the moment. It's really...
And you're so popular.
Yeah, but it's weird because I just go, no, because I can't even think about it. And it's really weird what cuts through sometimes. And yeah. Someone goes, and you're like, that's interesting. And, you know, there's certain movies, you know, you get offered and you're like, they say they want it really different, but you know, they always say they want it really different, but you know they're not going to. It's going to end up being like bang, bang, bang. And, it, you know, it depends the kind of movie. If you're doing like a very straight studio action kind of movie, there's going to be a lot of pressure. It's like being a director. Danny Boyle will only do movies under 20 million because he can keep control of them then.
Yeah.
And when you've got like big, big movies, there's a lot of pressure for them to sound like everything else. So I'm trying to like make things not sound like everything else under the radar.
With Molly's Game, for example, when you know you were like, what does it sound like? Do you then pitch to Erin what you think the sound is going to be then?
With Molly's Game, I met Erin in Toronto where he was filming. We went for like dinner at the Four Seasons, which was the most Erin Sorkin kind of dinner. It was an amazing dinner. It's just like we started talking about the liquor industry and how to make the best whiskey sours. And it was like one of these things like, oh my God, I feel like I'm in an Erin Sorkin film. I remember having this conversation just thinking, I actually sound really intelligent for once, which doesn't often happen. And anyway, he talked through like what he wanted to do with the music. He basically wanted like a strong melody, like a theme for Molly that paid off at the end. Mm. That was his main thing. And he was like, I want this big orchestral score. And I was thinking, no, you don't want that for this film. So I kept kind of saying, I don't think this film wants that, because reading the script, it was very contemporary. And I wanted to capture that world of these guys playing poker and Molly fitting into that world. It was quite a grubby, undergroundy, contemporary world. I wanted to reflect that in the music. So I said, look, let me do what I think I want to do. If you don't like it, fine, we can bin it.
Yeah.
And we can go for plan B. But I always try and do that. I always basically say, look, let me do something. If you don't like it, we can always bin it and try something else. And that does happen often. But if I get in early enough, I can basically fail, which is my big thing of trying to do stuff that possibly is going to fail. And then we've got time for a backup. So with that, I was just sort of trying to just make a score that felt like almost like a band score.
Yeah.
Like almost like a bunch of bands had scored this movie rather than a film composer. I didn't really want it to feel like a film composer score. Yeah.
About from the work you've done on Steve Jobs, that connection? Or
yeah, I'd met him on Steve Jobs at the end when we did a bit of promotion for it, and then we went to the Golden Globes together. This makes me sound like I'm some kind of real cheesy but yeah, I sat next to him and Molly was on our table, the real Molly from Molly's Game.
Wow.
And I didn't know who she was at this point. She sort of explained that she ran this kind of poker game and that a lot of people in this room were really pissed off with her. And I thought she was talking about bankers or like investment people. I didn't know. I didn't realize it was all the actors. Yeah, so he basically really loved what I did for Steve Jobs. He was like, you've written me an opera. That's like the greatest gift ever. I was like, oh, that's nice. Erin is amazing at compliments, you know. If I ever feel really down, I'll just read the sleeve notes to Molly's Game probably. That will get me back up. He's like really warm, lovely guy to work for. And you know, for me also, it was amazing that was his first movie he directed, because it really felt like he'd done about 20 beforehand. And I guess he's been in the game a long time, so he's been slowly picking stuff up secretly and then has just worked out how to, you know, make a film and do it really well.
Can we talk about Steve Jobs? Because it was it was incredible in terms of that, you know, the three acts of it all, almost, and kind of trying to have different, I guess, different scores for each of those. And it was really brilliant hearing you describe them, and I think you were kind of, you know, it gave you an opportunity in one of them to kind of be the 80s keyboard wizard that you'd always wanted to be and things like
that. Yeah, that was me living my Vangelis Jean-Michel Jarre fantasies.
Your idea in terms of this sounding different for each kind of almost decade kind of thing?
Yeah, I met with Danny and, you know, I read the script and he talked about how he's going to do each act very differently, and I just thought, well, it seems a no-brainer, like, let's try and do every act musically differently. I like again, it's like, how do you give something some kind of identity? Like, how can you make a film feel special?
Yeah.
And, you know, ideas like that are like a really strong way in, because the thing about doing a film is like having a blank piece of paper, and if someone says, draw me a picture, draw me 10 pictures, you're like, I don't know what, I could draw anything. But if you say, draw me 10 cars, you're like, okay, I can draw 10 cars and make them really cool, or I don't know, whatever I'm going to do. But you're going to remember it. Hey, that guy did, I know this is a bad metaphor, but like, hey, do you remember that painting of 10 cars? Yeah, great. Rather than like, do you remember those 10 random paintings that didn't make any sense or look like every other painting? So for me, that's a strong way in to start off how I'm going to approach a score, and like have an idea, like try and come up with some kind of concept in my head of what I want it to sound like, and then start exploring that kind of sound world or melodic world. And I love the idea of going from technology and like the birth of technology and the limitations and excitement of technology in the 80s, which felt, it was really exciting, like synthesizers and computers, it felt like the future. Like, nothing really feels like the future anymore. Like, the things that feel like the future are really depressing, like weird social media apps. Whereas that sound was really exciting. So I wanted to capture, and also the launch of the Mac, you know, it's like this whole new world, which has basically from that point transformed our world now. So I wanted to capture that spirit. But then we have a second act. I wanted to capture this like P.T. Barnum aspect of like Steve Jobs, which is this like showman, and create this very kind of grand operatic sound. And then by the third act, I wanted to kind of do the digital world we live in now, which is just doing everything on the iMac.
With it in terms of, you see, you like to get in as early.
Oh yeah, I mean, I was working before they were even filming, so
amazing.
I was writing.
Is that the dream?
Yeah, it's kind of the dream. I mean, well, the real dream is to say, hey Dan, we've got this movie, it's got to be finished next week, can you just come up with a really great idea? And you do it, first idea, and they have to take it, and it's brilliant and it works. That's the dream.
Okay.
But it's never really going to happen.
Yeah,
no, I like having a lot of time. So on that, as soon as I got the script, I was on board, I was writing. Danny was shooting it in order as well. So he was doing act one, then act two and act three. So I was sending him stuff while he was on set and he'd send me notes. He sends really good notes. He's a very diligent director, Danny. And it was going really well, which was annoying because I was going to go out to San Francisco and hang out with everyone on set. And they were basically like, we don't want to send you out because it's going really well. So we want you to keep doing what you're doing. I was like, oh, shit. I was looking forward to a little trip to San Francisco to hang out with Michael Fassbender.
Didn't happen.
No, I just sat at home feeling
mate.
Very unglamorous.
Then you got to go and do the, you know, the press tour though and hang out with them all. So you...
Yeah, hang out with them a bit. No one really cares about composers.
I do.
Yeah, you
I
do.
Really
this
do.
Is great.
I really do. Ridley Scott as well, you know, you kind of worked with Ridley a couple of times.
Yeah.
How did that relationship start?
Well, Ridley's kind of like the big key towards everything that happened to me in some ways. I did a movie called The Awakening, which was a great overlooked movie by this fantastic director called Nick Murphy.
You've done a number of things with
him. Yeah, so I've worked with Nick a lot and I love Nick. And Nick is like really good at using music and understanding how to make music work. And anyway, this film comes out, Rebecca Hall, Dominic West, period ghost story. It's a great film. Go see it.
It really is a great film.
And I basically, like, that's my first big film score. And I was just like, right, I'm sinking everything. You know, I spent the entire budget. Like, I made no money. I just spent everything on the score because I was like, it's got to sound amazing. And we did a really cool, I was really, really proud of that film. But it kind of came out, you know, like many films do, did a bit and then disappeared, and that was kind of it. But what did happen was Ridley Scott saw it, and he came in one day and was just raving about it in the edit to his editor, who's this guy, amazing guy called Pietro Scalia, who's like the greatest editor, who did like Gladiator, JFK, Black Hawk Down, Good Will Hunting, like super legend. And I'd worked with him on a short film ages ago and we were kind of buddies, and he was like, oh, I know Daniel, you know, I've been telling you about him. And he's like, anyway, so like, let's get him in for a meeting. So I had a meeting with Ridley Scott and he like quizzed me on how I did things and everything. And he was like, the thing about it that I always say, but it was really interesting, he was like, he basically said to me, I learned everything through doing advertising, and I did my 10,000 hours in the garage doing adverts, and I learned how to direct. And he's like, you've done that in TV, you've done your 10,000 hours in the garage, so I can see that. So I was like, that's the coolest compliment, like Ridley Scott saying, you know, you've earned your stripes the way I earned my stripes, which is just doing, because Ridley's a doer.
Yeah,
he's just like, just do. So we get on pretty well because I've kind of got a like that, like, fuck it, let's just do it attitude. And so yeah, I did The Counselor with him. Yeah, that was great. And so that was the start. Once you got the kind of Ridley Scott thumbs up, like, the film is a bit like a sort of party, and there's a big bouncer on the door, basically, and you can't just turn up and go, hey, I'm a composer. They'll go, ah, no, you can't come in. But a director might get their first little invite in. They'll go in. And what happens, the doorman might say to Nick Murphy, for instance, he'd be like, right, what's your name? Nick Murphy. In you come. Oh, is that guy with you? Daniel. He's not a film guy. And Nick either goes, oh, isn't he? Sorry. See you later, Dan. Bye. Or he goes, oh, no, he's with me. He's coming in, or I'm not coming in. And they go, oh, yeah, all right. So you come in. And then you're in the little party, and you've got to kind of hang around and see if you can get chucked out quickly. But then, like, you know, when Ridley Scott spots you and you start chanting to Ridley, oh, he's chanting to Ridley Scott. Oh, he must be important. He must know what he's doing. And then suddenly, once you've done that a bit, everyone's like, oh, yeah, yeah, he knows what he's doing. We'll hire him for a movie, possibly.
And you're still in the party.
I'm still in the party, just about. I've got, like, a load of canapes in my pocket that no one's seen. I've stashed some booze around somewhere in case it runs out.
You say you're at the party, though, but you are genuinely a fan of film as well, because I see you at lots of things. I remember seeing you going to a couple of premieres just to watch the film, you know, not necessarily working on them. But then also we were talking about how you'd been at a couple of events that Clint Mansell had done, to watch a Q&A that he'd done and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You love the world. You're a fan of the world.
Oh, yeah, I mean... like, I love, like, what other composers are doing. You know, like, my favourite kind of movies, I go one, and I go, am I allowed to swear on this?
Yeah,
I just go, fuck! Like, if I'm watching a film and it makes me go, fuck, it's really good and annoying. Because basically, a really good score makes me go, fuck! Because I'm like, damn, that's, like, way better than I would have done, or more interesting. And I get really excited by music where I go, this is exactly what I want to be doing, but this person's doing it better than me. And not that I think I'm, like, super great, but I just always trying to, like, push for, like, trying to do something I feel is really original. And every time I hear someone else do something like that and they do it better, way better, I get really a mixture of, like, incredibly excited, incredibly depressed.
What was the last film that made you go, ah?
I haven't seen Black Panther yet, but the score is really good. Like, I listened to the score, Ludwig's score, and I was actually in Abbey Road when he was recording it, and I actually snuck in.
Did you?
In the percussion section and just hid behind there, which is really interesting for me because, like, I'm not normally in orchestral sessions. I'm normally, like, sat in a room, like, putting my hair out, like, looking at the clock. But to be in someone else's session was quite good fun. But when I there, they're just doing orchestral stuff, so I hadn't heard all the stuff he'd done in Africa. So when you hear that score and you hear all the different elements in it, it's really, especially for that kind of movie, like a big studio superhero movie, it's really exciting.
To Ryan actually about it, and Nate the producer, and hearing the kind of the research that Ludwig had done on it, going to...
He really did do his research. Everyone says, oh, I did my research, which basically means, oh, I met a guy who plays a sitar or something.
going to DRC and that, and speaking and chatting to and recording proper local musicians to that area and stuff as well. So it was really interesting to hear them kind of talk about the depth of research that he'd kind of done for that.
Yeah. Every time there's good work, I, like, get excited. You know, I love going to movies when you see a good film.
Yeah.
And or you hear a great score. You know, every time you do a film, everyone tried, okay? You know, some people might not have tried as hard as the others, but no one wants to go and make a bad movie. Everyone wants to make a good movie. And I have so much more sympathy for what seem like bad movies now. because to make a perfect movie is so, it's like so many factors. Every single person on that production has to be at the top of their game, like really doing it. You know, there's so much effort goes into any kind of production. It's amazing. Once you can start appreciating that, it's always really fascinating because they're just these great works of art that just exist, and sometimes they're like lousy works of art, but there'll always be something in them. It's a bit like, I say, if you go to some sort of dinner and you're stuck next to someone who's quite boring, I'm always like, they must have something interesting. There's some story in there that's really interesting. And it's like trying to find that. And when you find it, it's great.
Yeah.
And I always think that same with films. You know, even if a film's not perfect, there'll always be something in there that you can appreciate.
Yeah. Do you know what I loved as well? One of the films that you worked on, Cuban Fury.
Okay. Oh, good.
Yeah. I mean, I love Nick Frost. I could watch Nick sleeping and he would make me feel happy.
Really? I think you might find that a bit weird. Yeah.
It was a lovely story, that film, in terms of getting that script to Naira and stuff and not having the courage to send her it. And it's a brilliant story and I love that. I love when kind of good people, good things happen. And it was a funny, brilliant experience watching that film.
Yeah, that was fun. Although there's my biggest bugbear is I did this insanely complicated record scratching scene for a fight and I ended up using the temp music and I still kind of go, ah! Like, I remember spending a massive train journey, London to Edinburgh, editing 5 hours of record scratching to, like, make this whole sequence, like, all work. Like, I'd record all these horns and I'd resampled them and re-scratched them. And anyway, they ditched it for a cut chemist track. Ah, I'm still bitter.
Oh dear, I wish I'd mentioned.
No. But I got a lot of love for that film. It's a really fun movie.
Yeah, really fun. Mentioned Vangelis. So what other composers are kind of big influences on you, or you're a big admirer of?
Well, like, number one is probably Morricone. Like, he's the kind of all-time one, just because his career is so crazy and it sort of feels like he doesn't give a fuck a lot of the time. It's just like, yeah, I'm gonna make some duck sounds on top of this like action sequence. And the kind of things sometimes you go, well, what the hell is he doing? And you're like, it's so weird that it's brilliant. I mean, what I love about Morricone is his like unbelievable talent for just melody and emotion and just hitting you in the heart in 2 seconds. Mm. But then also his just really experimental adoption of interesting sounds. I mean, some of those scores are so weird, but because they've become kind of part of popular culture, you don't even question the fact that, like, I think it's Good, Bad and the Ugly, the main theme, there's just people just think, we will fight. It's crazy. We can fight. We can fight.
We can fight.
and you're just used to those tracks, but you start pulling them apart and it's amazing. And if you really want an amazing experience of like what a composer can do in their life, go on Spotify or something, click Morricone and just click shuffle, and he's got what, like 50 years of music, and it's so varied and so fascinating. Yeah. That just hitting shuffle is the most amazing way to experience someone's output, and my dream is to one day someone hit shuffle on me.
I love that. I love what he did most recently with the Tarantino film. That kind of opening shot. It's just...
I mean, that's kind of like a weird classic Morricone, like...
But the fact that he kind of wrote a horror score, you know, for a Western...
Yeah, and totally ignored what... Like, when you see interviews with Tarantino, like, okay, yes, I'm a bit of a geek, and I do go to lots of things like this. So I've never seen his interviews with Tarantino, and he kind of seemed pretty pissed that Morricone hadn't done exactly what he thought he was going to do. And, of course, what I think a good composer does... not all the time, but sort of kind of listens to the director, but kind of also ignores them. I think a great composer takes on board stuff, but kind of also says, no, you don't want this, you want this. Mm. And, you know, Morricone is just a fascinating, great example of that. And there's loads of others. I mean, I could just rattle names off for ages.
It's funny you saying that, because I remember when we did, we spoke to Derek C. in France for the podcast, and he was talking about kind of being pushed outside his comfort zone by his composer, by Alexandre Desplat, for his last film, like Between the Oceans.
Yeah.
And how, he never expected it to be his composer who pushed him outside his comfort zone to challenge himself, and he found it the most rewarding experience.
Yeah,
that's great to hear.
I mean, Desplat is really interesting. Like, again, got a lot of love for Desplat's work when he's not being lazy. But when he's, like, really throwing everything in, he's... Yeah. I mean, even like a not great Desplat score is still, like, a zillion times better than most. But what's interesting about him is he's very much... Well, from what I know, he does it. And it's like, here you go. And he's very, like, I know best, like, in terms... Not like I know, but he's not... I feel like very bad talking out of hand here about composer, but his attitude of like, I'm a composer, I know what I'm doing, let me do what I do. Mm-hmm. And he's got a very charming personality. It means he can like force those things through, which is why his score sounds so great, because he's not bending over backwards to appease every note. Obviously he will be some, but like the reason I think his scores have such a great sound is because he's got a very strong mindset and a sort of singular vision of like how to achieve them.
How do you think you're described as a composer?
Oh, messy, clown-like. I don't know. Depends who's...
Who you're asking.
Who you're asking. Drunk. I don't know. It's. I kind of like. I would like to be a kind of composer. It's hard to work out who they are, mm-hmm. in a way. Like, if you listen to All the Money in the World, and then you listen to...
Uncle.
Yeah, or like Molly's Game, or even like the Black Mirror thing recently. You kind of go, like, they all feel slightly different. I think I've got a sound, certain sort of things. Like, there's a lot of rhythmic stuff recently. But I would always like to be the kind of composer where you kind of go, ooh, I can't wait to hear what they're going to do next. Where you're going to be excited rather than like, well, I know what this is going to be. It'll be nice and lush.
Well, from what you... very kindly just let me hear a little bit from Ocean's 8. I can't wait to see the film from hearing that.
Okay, oh good. Yeah. That might change. I don't know. We're recording in 2 weeks and we seem to be changing it still every couple of days.
score was absolutely brilliant. In terms of kind of the score having its own voice,
yeah,
but it also being perfect for the film. I just thought it was great, and we spoke to Guy about it, and I know that he worked too hard. He
yep.
himself admitted that he made your life hell. I think those were his words.
And I would say that's a very polite and charitable way of putting it.
Can I take you back if it's not too painful?
Yeah, fine.
It's
fine. It's fine. With that, like, it took a long time to work out what Guy wanted, because he's quite vague in his direction. Mm-hmm. Like, I always say his greatest strength is that he doesn't want things to feel like stuff you've heard before and sound like things you've heard before. So, you know, if you started doing stuff that sounded like 60s Bond stuff, it'd just be like, this is bollocks. And he always wants things that feel unusual. And that can totally transform a scene. And also, the music really drives his films. So as a composer, that is great, because you're basically becoming like a very big part of the puzzle of the film.
Yeah.
You know, it's like being a leading man, whereas often you might be a supporting actor or something. But it also means you have like loads and loads of pressure on you, and it really has to work. Because if it doesn't, then the film doesn't work. So with that, you know, we'd have all these sequences. You know, there's a lot of sequences, and he wants them all to feel like tracks. He doesn't really like them feeling like film score. And I've worked with, he's got this amazing editor, who's this guy called James Herbert, who's just genius, brilliant guy. Mm. And so I'd often work very closely with James, and we'd come up with ideas that would get to Guy, and then Guy would kind of give his Emperor-style thumbs up or thumbs down. And so you'd end up redoing scenes like many, many, many times, like multiple, multiple, multiple times. Some things you would stick quite quickly, others would just, like, you just want to like shoot yourself because you've redone the sequence and like for the 100th time. You know, there's things like, there's a really big sequence at the end where there's this big raid, and that was done in a couple of hours in an evening at like 11 at night or something, where I got a phone call saying there's a screening tomorrow, studio looking at it, we've got to change the sequence, just do something different. And I was just like, oh man, I don't know what I'm gonna, like, and this happens quite a lot, and it's be like, all right, so I just come up with something, and that sometimes creates some good stuff. I mean, on King Arthur, we had that quite a lot. You know, a couple of the best sequences in King Arthur are because it was just like, oh, shit, I've got to do something in the morning. And it's like, it's 11 o'clock at night, mm-hmm. and I can't get hold of any musicians because no one's going to want to work for you at this time. So I have to do everything myself, and I can't do this very well. So there's like a couple of things in King Arthur. There's a bit where they go to Darklands. There's this bat sequence. It's got this mad kind of wow, wow, wow sort of sound. And that is literally me going wow, 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 because I couldn't work out. I knew what I wanted to get as a sound, but I couldn't work out how I could get it in time. So I just basically got a microphone and went wow, wow, wow. And then I put loads of distortion on it. I was like, actually, this sounds kind of cool. and you listen to it, and that obviously now I've given the game away slightly, but, you know, that's quite an unusual part of the film, and it only exists because I didn't have any time. Mm-hmm. I didn't have anyone to work with, so I just, me going wow. Stuff like there's a bit, I think it's like 2 a.m. or something, and there's this really weird thing of my face being like totally red because I've been going like slapping my face for like an hour and trying to make all these noises. And I just remember thinking, man, this is not how I envisaged doing Hollywood films, with me on my own in my flat 2 a.m. with a red face, having slapped it for like an hour trying to redo this cue for the 100th time. But then that ended up in the movie, and it's like quite a cool sequence.
That's brilliant. Call 11 o'clock at night, and you've got to deliver something by the morning. Where do you look for inspiration? What's your kind of?
It's often like blind panic. It's kind of like like I like trying to create all the sounds. Like I'm trying to make every sound in a film like something that only exists in that film.
Yeah.
So I try not to use like here's the cool samples of the day or mm-hmm. presets. So I always try and build my own instruments or sounds.
There was a great one I watched actually you doing in one of the videos on YouTube, which was he'd sampled the distortion of a guitar, and then you'd made that a kind of a file that you'd put through a keyboard, and then you use it was brilliant.
Yeah,
amazing.
I try and do a lot of that.
Yeah.
This is a just a guitar feedback hum put through a tremolo, and then I'm fiddling around with the tremolo speed, and you can hardly hear it, but just it just gives it this really, which is not really going to come across on this very well, I don't imagine, but it just gives it this amazing warm sort of sound that's totally natural, you know, but it sounds like a synth. It's got some interesting kind of movement in it, like stereo. And
I always think if you can make music that's very hard for people to copy, not that I really care about people copying it, but I like that thing of like, you know, someone else can't get this keyboard and press that one button and do the same thing. You know, even like on Oceans at the moment, like we found the studio we're using in New York had this stairwell where they'd recorded the drums for Born in the USA. So that snare, sound. We just found this out by accident when we just asked for a tour of like the other bits. And he says, oh, this is a stairwell. And I was like, okay, hang on, this is really cool. Can we use the stairwell? And they're like, yeah, sure. So we ended up miking up the stairwell and recording bongos for the film, which sounded great, crazy, massive reverb. And then I was like, oh, we've got to record some other stuff in here. So I ended up recording with claps and other percussion. And then now I've got a whole bunch of these really cool, weird percussive sounds, which I'm just dropping in, which I might not have done if I hadn't fiddled around in that stairwell. You know, in the pressure of the studio time, I wouldn't have been like, hey, let's spend like 5 hours hitting jingle bells in the stairwell just to see what it sounds like.
That's amazing. That kind of, it's so kind of, I hate using that word organic, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it is that kind of, that natural progression of ideas that and places and everything around you seems to inspire or influence what you're doing.
Every composer spends way too much time looking at a computer screen and not enough engaging with music in the way we should engage with it. Working on the computer gives you an amazing control for writing and precision, but moving away from that, you get like a whole different world of like energy, chaos, and it's trying to sort of take a bit of that world and then still have the order, because when you're doing like big films, if it's just all energy and chaos, it's impossible to make it work, which is why a lot of big films end up sounding quite similar. Even if you look at like something like John Williams, for instance, it's very hard to write that kind of very melodic orchestral writing if your cut is changing every couple of days. You know, if you're writing something that's a bit more, I don't want to say modern, but like pared back, minimal and grid-like, it's easy to chop out a few bars. But if you've musically got something that has to hit a certain point and they're changing the cut every day, it's a nightmare. So that's kind of like one of the things with modern films. You know, you've got to work as a composer in the world you live in. You know, you can say, oh, I really want to be like John Williams and write these big things. But the reality is, if you've got a cut that's changing every day, you have to come up with a different way of working, because the way you want to work is not going to get the best result on screen at the end, because it'll either be chopped to crap or it won't make any sense. So on the big films, you'd always try and work out some kind of system of like, how are we going to deal with this? So like on Oceans, for instance, we recorded a whole load of stuff in New York and we've done it so it's very easy to edit the performances, and then I'm rewriting stuff on top of that. I mean, it's like a weird puzzle. Every job is a puzzle, and I don't have a system. Like some composers have a system and it's like, here's what I do, we do this, and then this happens. But I like not having that, because it means every film is going to be different. And then I'm doing a film which I can't talk about yet.
That's all right. It means we can come back for next episode.
Yeah, yeah. With a very good director I might have worked with before. And we're talking about trying to record it on my iPhone, because I did some stuff on my iPhone and it sounds so rough. That it was sort of fascinating how emotional the kind of crapness, not the crapness, but just having that recording quality. You know, I'm just always interested in like what's going to create something different. You know, you could get more emotion out of an iPhone stuck by the piano and playing a few little notes on the piano possibly than a 90-piece orchestra at Abbey Road. I'm not saying you would, but I'm saying there's always the possibility of every different medium having its, you know, it's like the thing that's great about being a film composer is this thing of straddling all these different worlds of music, and you actually start to see music in a very pragmatic way. And there's so much snobbery in the world about music. And they're like, oh, orchestral music, you must be a proper composer. Oh, rock music, that's silly. And rock people are like, oh, classical music's boring, you know. But you start to look at like, okay, well, what gives you power? Like a rock band with like distorted guitar and one electric bass and a drum can have more power than like a 60-piece orchestra. But the same time, the six-piece orchestra like might have a precision or a different weight, or can transform itself into other things very quickly. And so you start to look at like the strengths of every type of music and the weaknesses. You know, like a 909 kick drum sounds great. It's so like tough. Whereas, you know, if you do a track with a 909 note and you're trying to make it really emotional, it's probably not going to be great. Although it could be, but
in the right situation.
In the right situation. Yeah. I mean, someone who can write an emotional cue on just on a 909 kick drum will get massive hats off from me.
What's the, not wish list, but do you have kind of, do you have things that you want to do on people you want to work with?
Sort of. I used to like be like, oh, I really want to work with this person. But then you kind of find out, oh, they've like a total nightmare with music. Like, I think for me, it's always a project. The idea of like a project coming up that kind of makes me go, ooh, that's, you know, like certain worlds, like I always secretly did want to do the new Blade Runner. Like, I dropped lots of very unsubtle hints to Ridley constantly. Which didn't work because he wanted me to do his film. I was just like, oh,
selfish.
Yeah, well, that's, I'd really like to do Dune. We'll see. I don't know. I mean, to be honest, it's like every project is different. And when I was working on TV, every story was kind of had some sort of fun challenge. I did a, I'm just trying to think off the top of my head, I did this like documentary years ago about people obsessed, sexually obsessed by fat people, right? Like really, really massive, massive fat people. And they couldn't move out of their house. And that was their turn on. And you're like, now I probably wouldn't do that show. But even that time, I was like, right, how can I make this interesting?
Yeah.
So I ended up recording myself singing over, like, Barry White tracks at, like, double speed so I could slow down and just sound like Barry White, like this kind of, whoa. Like, you know, oh,
Chopped and Screwed type vibe.
A bit like, oh, you know, Oh Yeah by Yellow.
Yeah.
Like I just did a score like that, which was, and that was just fun, just slowing your voice down. And you're like, hey, this is a cool trick, and this is an interesting way of doing a documentary about massive, massive, massive people who can't get out of bed because they're basically kind of in this very weird relationship where someone else won't let them leave the house, so they keep feeding them food.
Oh my God.
But you know, it's like every story, like,
yeah, it's got its purpose, and it's got, it also got its journey for you in terms of, you know, what you creatively do and bring to a project along the way and leads on to the next thing.
Just trying to come up with a new, different way of doing what you do each week. Well, not each week, but you know, each project gets you excited because it's not like, it's not like another day at the office. It's like, right, what we're doing now, how are we going to make this exciting for me and for everyone who watches it? Because I'm the thing I'm always like is when people watch it, how are they going to feel? Like, I basically want to be the guy in the cinema going, yeah, this is cool. Like,
fuck,
I'm enjoying this. Yeah. Yeah, I basically want every other composer to be going, fuck.
That feels like the perfect place to say thank you. But please, can we come back for part two when you can talk more about the next project you visit and a director you might have worked with already.
Yeah.
Thanks for your time.
Okay. Cheers. All right. Thanks so much.
Thank
Bye.
You. From the score to Ocean's 8, that's Sloppy Soup Samba by Daniel Pemberton, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with the supremely gifted British composer. My huge thanks to Daniel for taking the time to talk to us and for sharing so many great stories about the movies he's worked on. Ocean's 8 is out in some places around the world already, and in the UK on Monday the 18th of June. Now you can catch up with all of our previous episodes via iTunes, including my chats with composers Justin Hurwitz, Clint Mansell, Junkie XL, Nicholas Bertel, and Radiohead's Philip Selway, amongst many others. That's also the place to rate and subscribe to the podcast. Now, we have a dedicated Spotify playlist for Soundtracking, which is where you can hear the vast majority of the cues we play in the order they appear. So if you haven't yet checked that out, then please do, because you can explore the wonderful music that we're able to include in the podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK, and please do continue to spread the word for us. Next up, returning for a second sitting, is director J.A. Bayona, who we thoroughly enjoyed talking to about his previous film, A Monster Calls. He's back to tell us about his experience of working on Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Expecting heavy downpours all day today.
You're a builder. You build. It's literally in your job title.
Woo! Let's hit it.
A little rain isn't stopping you. Not today, not any day. Shouldn't your flashing tape be working through it all too? Only Frog Tape Pro Grade Flashing Tape's high-performance acrylic adhesive sticks, re-sticks, and stays stuck, even on the roughest surfaces in rain, snow, heat, and more. So you stay in control when it matters most. Show weather who's boss with Frog Tape Pro Grade Flashing Tape.